I'm John Kroll. The prolonged economic slump has affected almost every part of American life, including the work of those people and organizations who just want to do good. A sluggish economy means that not-for-profits often struggle for funds, just at the time when people need those not-for-profits the most. Today on No Limits, we will talk about how the slowdown has affected not-for-profits and the people they serve with our guests. Ellen Anila of the United Way of Central Indiana, Michael Petrie of the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir, and Rebecca Seifert of the Gennesaret Free Clinic. And you, please call in toll-free at 1-866-476-3881 or email us at nolimits@wfyi.org. You also can send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Now, the day's news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about managing not-for-profits in an extended economic downturn. We're fortunate to have as our guests Ellen Anila, the United Way of Central Indiana president. Ellen, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Great to be here.
It's good to have you here. Michael Petrie, executive director of the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir. Michael, welcome to the program.
My pleasure to be here.
It's good to have you here. And Rebecca Seifert, executive director of the Gennesaret Free Clinic.
Thank you. Rebecca, welcome to the program. Thank you so very much.
It's good to have all of you here. Our listeners can join the conversation today by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. I'd like to start a little bit by talking about, just in general terms, how the slowdown has affected what you do, what the practical impact has been. And I'll start with you, Ellen Anila.
Well, you know, when you're focused on human services, which is what our field is, human services and young people and education and early childhood, business really booms for us in an economic downturn. That's when people need us more than they do normally. And then at the same time, fundraising is a real challenge. So what we see with a lot of our agencies is they are operating really on a shoestring. And we've been fortunate in this community because the funders work very well together. I'm sure from an arts perspective, in an economic downturn like this, that sometimes there's some real chagrin because a number of the funders have turned towards human services. But we've been able to put together a community economic relief fund and have had several million dollars that we've made available to a number of organizations. And because we know that it's for client services for very basic needs like clothing, food, housing, help with the rent or the mortgage, utility assistance, and over 3 years period, better than 50% of the people who have called in for help are first-time callers. They're the first time people ever asking for help. So they probably were donors 3 years ago and contributors, but now they're in a dire straits. But we've allowed agencies to use part of the money to keep their casework staff on because you can put some money out there, but if you don't have the infrastructure to deliver it. So it's a challenge for human service agencies.
And has your fundraising stayed level, or is it?
No, for our fundraising, this year is actually a good year. And I've had business reporters call me to get what the mood is in companies. And we've had wonderful response from companies. They're running earlier. There's a lot of enthusiasm. We are very optimistic about making goal. So we're feeling much better about that. But the prior 3 years, we were either holding our own or slightly down. So that was a real challenge because we weren't seeing the increase commensurate with the need that was out there, and we've had to reduce our agencies 3 years in a row.
Michael Petrie, Ellen made the point that sometimes the arts get hurt when there's a time of real need because the funding goes toward helping people who are in desperate straits. Has that been the case for for your organization, the Symphonic Choir?
It's certainly a familiar sentiment that we hear quite often from individual donors, but also from lots of our corporate partners and grant-making institutions just the same. She's exactly right in these times. I think we all tend to focus on those essential items, not saying the arts are not important, of course, very important to the fabric of the community. But we do hear that a lot. And the Symphonic Choir perhaps is fortunate to say that over the past 3 or 4 years, we've seen giving increase in all of our categories, individual, corporate, and our granting partners. I don't know that I would say that's the case across the board, though.
What accounts for that? Because that's not, frankly, a story I'm hearing from a lot of not-for-profits these days.
I think part of that, and this may be the arts or across the nonprofits in general, those patrons with whom you're especially close and perhaps have a multi-year or sometimes multi-generation relationship with them, they stick by your side. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you can go to them and say, here's the situation, our ticket sales are struggling, and XYZ grantor has had to pull back and support an essential human need institution, can you step up? Can you help us? Can you, you know, temporarily for a couple years double your gift? I think kind of calling in those chips, if you will, has been a very helpful thing for the Symphonic Choir and for other arts groups. Certainly that's not something that's sustainable. The economy does need to rebound, and we need to see that diversification come back that we had 5 or 6 years ago or in the past.
Rebecca Seifert, first, I think probably we ought to talk a little bit about what the Gennesaret Free Clinic is and does, before we get to sort of the funding challenges that you face. Could you describe a little bit of the work that your organization does?
Sure. We're a largely volunteer healthcare agency. Our target audience are very, very low-income people who reside in Marion County. We have medical services, clinic rooms located in various homeless shelters, food pantries. We have a wellness clinic as well. We have a dental clinic. We have a women's health initiative that provides early detection for breast and cervical cancer. We have a vision care program, and we have a health recovery program for homeless men who've been hospitalized and need a place to heal. So we have a staff of 14, full and part-time, and about 220 volunteers. All of our services are basically free of charge.
What is your budget? I mean, how do you pay for all of that?
Yeah, I beg, borrow, and steal. No, our budget is about $1.3 million this year. Part of it comes from in-kind donation of time, volunteer physicians, dentists, nurses, pharmacists, etc. We also have partnerships with various healthcare organizations to provide in-kind staffing and support. So that's part of where I get our funds. And then, you know, individual donors, grant makers from the SERF Community Emergency Relief Fund, fundraising events. I look at strategic partnerships with the services we provide. Who in the community could we go to and say, would you mind supporting this part of my budget?
We are talking about the struggles of not-for-profits in difficult times here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Well, let's talk really about when things are tough, what has to be sacrificed. I mean, where are the priorities? I think I'll start with you, Rebecca, in part because I think to some degree you're sort of at ground zero on all of this, in that you are providing a service that likely has a much greater demand during difficult times, and yet you're also squeezed on the other side because the money is harder to come by.
That's absolutely true. And also, we serve people to the lowest economic rung on the ladder. Mm-hmm. They have the least resources, no insurance, can't afford to pay for health care out of pocket. So it's, and we provide vital services. So it's important to me that those services continue. And, you know, during these tough times, again, I look at line items in my budget. What are we currently paying for that maybe someone could provide for us? Mm-hmm. So I try to cut budgets, talk to donors, and just look for strategic alliances.
What are you looking for right now? What line item do you need support for the most right now?
Gosh.
Where is the greatest stress point?
I'm looking for things around at our dental and wellness clinic. That's
okay.
And I don't have a, because I've been fortunate to form strategic alliances that cut some of those expenses. But, you know, again, we have pharmaceutical costs. It's tough to get medicines donated. So we try to manage our formulary. We try to look at those medications.
Could you break that down a little bit for people who don't speak the lingo?
Okay. We look at our patients and the medical conditions that they have, and then the medicines that we order, because medicines are crucial to our delivery of services and can be expensive. We look at, you know, those medicines that might be going off patent, those medicines that we can get for a reduced cost, and look at the type of conditions that we see so that we're making optimum use of dollars and cents.
And if somebody wants to help you with that, how should they get in touch? Don't worry, I'm going to give all of you the opportunity to do that.
Should give me a call.
I know I'm with fundraisers here.
They should give me a call at my office.
And that number would be?
Would be 639-5645, extension 201.
Okay, and is there a website or any place that they can take?
Yes, it is www.genesaret, and it's GENNESARET.org.
Okay, and that would be the way if they do want to help. I'm going to come back to you real quickly, Michael, when you do have a downturn or whatever, what are the things that get cast aside or pushed aside first for you?
Sure, this is all too familiar, I'm sure, for all of us right now. You know, I think I would kind of approach that question in much the way that we have in the boardroom from time to time. What can we absolutely not cut? What is mission critical? What defines who we are and what we do for the community? Those have to be the very last things to be cut. And we can look through the budget at specific line items, you know, here and there. But if it's mission critical, and if it's what makes us special in the community, those just have to be those items that the absolute last resort. And that takes some really tough soul searching and hard discussions with the board and staff, of course. One other thing that I kind of like on this cut, what do you cut, is what do you add? Because that also means you just have to change what you're doing. And Michael Kaiser, who's at the Kennedy Center in D.C., the chief of that, says, this is a time to do something out of this world. Mm. Do something bold. Do something that you've never done before. Now, don't do something that's necessarily going to break the bank, of course.
Yeah.
But that served us well, and I think it's a fresh approach during a downturn.
How large is your budget overall?
Our budget is the smallest, I think, of all the gang here. We're at about $500,000 annually.
Okay, and how many people does that employ or serve?
We'll reach about 25,000 people this year.
Okay, and how many people? How large is your staff?
We have a staff of 8 folks, and then the choir, of course, is made up of 175 volunteer singers.
We are talking about how not-for-profits struggle in a time of economic downturn here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We're talking with Ellen Anila, the United Way of Central Indiana, Michael Petrie of the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir, and Rebecca Seifert of Genesaret Free Clinic. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about managing not-for-profits during an extended economic downturn. Our guests are Ellen Anila of the United Way of Central Indiana, Michael Petry of Indianapolis Symphonic Choir, and Rebecca Seifert of the Gennesaret Free Clinic. Ellen, we were talking about really what goes, and in some ways we've talked about existing things, but you know, most not-for-profits in Central Indiana often has ways they want to push out the mission and expand initiatives. What of those had to be sacrificed as part of this?
Okay. Well, you know, we're in a unique position because we are both a fundraiser and a funder. And so we're seeing what's happening both with organizations that we fund and how they've had to streamline. And many of them, you know, you see executive directors who are not just executive directors and doing the HR function and doing the fundraising function. They're also being the custodian and the plumber and whatever else it takes to keep the organization going. And we've seen a lot of that in organizations. We've seen a lot of organizations who are looking at the kind of alliances that were mentioned earlier, but some of them are looking at very organic relationships where they are beginning, maybe short of mergers, but having very strategic alliances where somebody else is perhaps handling, some other organization or business is handling all of their administrative work, and they're looking for those kind of efficiencies. In our own at United Way, we also have had to look at that. When we pass on a reduction to the organizations we fund, we take that same reduction. So last year we had a task force, we called it the review task force, to look at everything we were doing that was not on core mission, just as Michael said. What are these things? Because we're 93 years old, and we're kind of the community generalist.
You don't look that old, man.
Well, thank you.
Anywhere near that old.
Thank you.
Yeah.
But we, when you've been kind of a community generalist, a lot of things get added to your plate. And so we've really tried to make sure that anything, if we keep it, it has to pay for itself. If it's some of these ancillary programs. And we've encouraged organizations we fund to make sure that they're building in the administrative support they need if they get a grant. So there are a lot of different levels that you have to work on to get through this. We dropped a few things and we modified some programs and we had to go through our own staff reduction.
And has that been sort of a change building in the administrative stuff? In the interest of full disclosure, I should say I've done a bit of fundraising in my life too. And I know often there would be in grants that they didn't want to pay for administrative pieces or anything like that, which frankly at the time always struck me as short-sighted. You're going to give us money and then tell us not give us the way to manage it basically appropriately.
Right. Yeah. A few years ago, the Central Indiana Community Foundation, Lilly Endowment, United Way, and the Chamber of Commerce actually did a study that was focused on United Way agencies, but I think it could be generalized to the whole nonprofit sector to look at whether or not first some were just kind of chasing the money, chasing any grants, and we found that most weren't. They were really looking for grants that, in fact, were mission critical. But secondly, what we did see is that too many in this much greater competitive environment were not asking for the kind of administrative support they need. Now, sometimes you don't have any choice. One of the things we handle are the FEMA dollars for Central Indiana, and these would be not the emergency funds. These would be the funds for homelessness, for homeless prevention, for meals, congregate meals, for emergency shelter. And we don't get a lot of money. In fact, this year we hardly got any for Marion County, but they give 1% for administration. Now, we pass that on to the provider. We don't take anything because, I mean, there's just not that much there. But there are times you go ahead and take it because it'll do some good in the community.
Yeah.
But when you can avoid doing that, and organizations, when they're competing for funds, very often think they got to cut that administrative so they'll be more competitive, and then they get themselves in trouble.
A lot of trouble. We are talking about managing not-for-profits in a time of economic stress. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can Facebook or tweet us at WFYI. We actually have gotten a Facebook question, Ellen, that was on your point about having to reduce staff. This is from Bob, a listener named Bob, who says, are you concerned with the number of nonprofit workers with long tenures having their positions eliminated due to budget concerns? Ellen, I'll start with you there, although I suspect everyone can talk about that one.
You know, that's one of the most painful things that I think anybody in an executive or administrative position ever has to do. And for, I think, the first reduction we ever had was in the mid-90s at United Way that I was aware of. And it's a very painful thing. And anytime you go through a reduction in force, you do a lot of evaluation. And it's very often, any reduction that I've been through, we really look again back at mission critical. What are the things that we have to keep going? And you look at it from that perspective first. And then you begin to look at who are the people who might be effective. And it's painful. It is very painful. And it's a tough environment for people to then find the level and quality of jobs they're in. So,
Michael Petry, I know you said earlier that you're one of the fortunate not-for-profits in that every giving category has gone up for you. Have you been in a position ever where it's had to reduce staff or lay people off?
Luckily, with the symphonic choir, no. Granted, we're at 8 people, so it's not as though there's a large staff. Full disclosure here, we were hit with ticket sales.
Mm-hmm.
Donations have been strong, as I said, but ticket sales, perhaps that's due because our dedicated people are staying close, but those that were on the line or less in love with the institution didn't have the generations of love. They're the people that had to make the choice.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's a $25 ticket, that's significant for everybody in this economy.
Mm-hmm. Rebecca Seifert, you said actually when we were on the break off the air that you leaned over toward Ellen and said basically that she had saved your life. Could you provide some, not specifically, and that we didn't have someone doing the Heimlich maneuver here in the studio, but in fact that United Way had provided a lifeline for Genesaret.
Yeah, back when the economy just hit the skids, of course, safety net agencies, of which Genesaret is one, are hardest hit. And not only do we see an increase, as Ellen said, in people, but a decrease in dollars. And so what the funders came together and created what is called the Community Emergency Relief Fund, otherwise known as SERF,
mm-hmm.
that provided needed funding to safety net agencies, including Genesaret, to help us deliver those mission-critical services that people need. So, yes, they saved our lives, and they saved it again this year. So I'm very grateful for that money to help us provide needed health care services.
Is that typical of not-for-profit communities across the country, or is this something that's specific to Indianapolis?
I think this is unique to Indianapolis. We have a group of funders that have been meeting on a monthly basis since 1978.
There's
about 15 funders around the table. Some of the ones that, you know, everyone knows, certainly Lumina, the Pulliam Trust, Central Indiana Community Foundation, Lilly Endowment, United Way, the city is a part of that. We've had representation from the state from time to time. It's not an incorporated group. It's a very informal mm-hmm. conversation. But because of that, and United Way has staffed mm-hmm. this over this time, and it goes back to the days that we had the Community Service Council, which was a planning organization.
Mm-hmm.
And the purpose is to just make sure we know what each other is doing. Because of that, we have a very close relationship with the funders here in town. And so Fairbanks is part of that. There are just many. Mm-hmm. And then a few family foundations, the Health Foundation. And we make sure we kind of watch trends. And because we have that infrastructure in place and because we have the relationship we do, that when everything came crashing down in October of 2008, we had this fund up and running within 2 months. And I've had many calls from around the country, both about how the funders coordinate here in central Indiana as well as this fund. And I just don't know of another community that responded as quickly and as effectively. That fund was depleted earlier this year, and we thought it would be the end. And mm-hmm. then we saw the continued calls. 211, which is the helpline, mm-hmm. had more than almost 270,000 calls last year. And we didn't see any decrease in that. So we've been able to revive the fund. Not all of the funders were able to come back, but a number of them were. So that's we're really delighted, again, because we have the relationship and the infrastructure in place to respond and manage.
Well, and I don't want to take us too long on this, but mm-hmm. I'm curious, how do those meetings run? I mean, who chairs them, in effect, or keeps everybody
One of our vice presidents does, and it's really, you know, each we'll identify different topics that we want to talk about each mm-hmm. month. And last month, we were in the mayor's office. We're able to visit with the mayor and get an update of what's happening there and what's happening with the Front Porch Alliance. Sometimes it's a health focus. We, like when Wishard was wanting to have the referendum on a new hospital. Well, we just try to keep ourselves updated, and then we always do organizational updates. So it's, again, it's an informal conversation, and there are times that it's not a group, it's a group of funders, it's not a funding body. Mm-hmm. So any funding is just still individually driven.
Well, do you share, you know, like if somebody comes to you and says, I mean, Michael, I'm going to use you as a purpose of demonstration. Michael comes to United Way and says, we got this great idea for a program, we really want to do it, and you say, in effect, it's not a good fit for us. At those meetings, will you talk to other funders then and say, somebody brought this great proposal, it won't work for us, might work for you?
We don't so much do that as much as try to just keep up on trends and what's going on. We look a lot at what's happening with 211 and the data that comes in there. When at United Way, we do a community assessment every few years, and we always present to that group and make sure that when we're preparing for the assessment, that we're getting feedback from that group and what they want to make sure that we look at. So it's a little higher level. We don't want it to become one where we're looking at every good idea. It's more how do we keep each other informed about each other. It's primarily focused on human services. It's not focused on the arts or environment. But
so I should have used Rebecca as my teaching right. tool here. We are talking about managing not-for-profits in an economic downturn here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Send a comment or question at WFYI. I want to stick with that point, though. In an economic downturn where even existing things, where do you go to try to find new money? Is it possible at all? Is that, Michael, you raised your eyebrows first, so I'll go with you. Is that possible? Or
that's a good question. I think our natural first reaction is to look at those people that we know first mm-hmm. and we know best, and to ask for a little bit more. So that is one option. If we think of a target, the image of a target, not to target our donors, of course. Or the Kandinsky concentric circles, if you know that piece of art. Let's think about the organization in the very center mm-hmm. of that target. And then who of our friends, family members, if you will, with the organization is closest to that center? We should go to them next. And then we go one ring out from there. Who's closely, but not as closely affiliated? And then we go to that. So a constituency model, I think, is what they call it, the PROS. That's a helpful tool. I think that our staff and board uses quarterly to just kind of replenish those that are in the pipeline. Also, though, I should say it's not just money, I think, that we all need. And now's the time when we can really look to folks to help nonprofits with volunteerism. It mm-hmm. it may not be their pockets. It may be their hands and their voice that can really help sustain a nonprofit during times like this.
And as I promised that there would be an opportunity here, if somebody wants to help the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir, how should they go about doing that?
Sure. The Symphonic Choir is grateful for all the help we receive. And they can visit indychoir.org or call 940-9057.
Could you give that number again, please?
Happy to.
Sure.
940-9057 or indiechoir.org.
We are talking about not-for-profits and their struggles in a prolonged economic downturn with our guests, Ellen Anila, Michael Petrie, and Rebecca Seifert. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Mary, welcome to the program. Your question, please.
Yes, I was wondering about with the limitations on funding that there is in this time of economic downturn, how the organizations make sure that their volunteers are still adequately trained to go out in the community and fulfill their mission? Because I know that they're obviously not getting paid, but obviously that training can still cost a great deal of money. And so how people can know when they're interacting with those organizations that the volunteers that they may be coming in contact with were still trained just as adequately as before funding took a downturn.
Good question. Thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
Well, Rebecca Seifert, I think I'll start with you, since your staff-to-volunteer ratio was almost off the charts. So,
yes. A lot of our volunteers, number one, are healthcare professionals.
Mm-hmm.
So they're physicians, nurses, dentists, pharmacists.
Mm-hmm.
And so they bring a set of skills with them in their practice that transfers into our setting.
Mm-hmm.
We do have, you know, volunteer orientation and things like that, but it's a transferable skill from what they do in their professional life to what they do in their volunteer life.
Now, do you have a role for, you know, I wanted to get involved at the Gennesaret Free Clinic. My medical skills extend to being able to open an aspirin bottle, and that's about it.
What I would have you to do is we have our volunteer clinics are staffed with a physician, a nurse, and a clerk, and you could be a clerk. You could drive our RV, 33-foot RV.
Oh, that sounds
like fun.
I
could use you to do that.
All right,
that
sounds like fun, although I might actually create more work for you than I would solve. Ellen Anila, how do you make sure that the volunteers who are associated get the proper training?
Well, I'll give you an example of what we do with our READUP program. READUP is, we've got about 1,000 volunteers right now who are trained in tutoring with third, fourth, and fifth graders in four of our counties at this point. And many in IPS schools and then other counties. And we have found that the training is critical. So we work with the schools where we can, and both our staff and their staff do training. We also found that volunteers, it's a training factor, it's a screening factor, and then they have to have a good experience to keep going. So we have also funded coordinators at schools to make sure that the volunteer experience is well organized, because you want those volunteers to keep coming back.
Well, clearly you've pleased somebody. We've gotten a tweet from a listener named Marco who says, congratulations to the United Way of Central Indiana for the great job in the community.
We
are talking about managing not-for-profits in an extended economic downturn. We're fortunate to have as our guests Ellen Anila, who is the president of United Way of Central Indiana, Michael Petrie, executive director of the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir, Rebecca Seifert, executive director of the Gennesaret Free Clinic. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. I am John Kroll. You are listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking about the struggles of not-for-profits in an economic downturn. We're fortunate to have as our guest Ellen Anila, president of the United Way of Central Indiana, Michael Petrie, executive director of the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir, and Rebecca Seifert, who is the executive director of the Gennesaret Free Clinic. We were talking, Ellen, on the break about really the growth of not-for-profits and the changes in the patterns and all of that. You've got some numbers, as I understand. Could you share those, please?
I sure will. You know, if you ask funders sometimes, they'll say, oh, no, we don't need more nonprofits. Of course, you hear when Gennesaret is fairly young, and that's one of those good new nonprofits. But it is a concern that many funders have about the growth in the nonprofit sector. Since 1975, the average growth in the nonprofit sector nationwide is about 47,000 per year that are being approved by the IRS.
Say that again.
47,000. That's the average since, that's the average growth from 2005 through 2010. So that's the more recent growth.
So what? That's about, if not-for-profits were people, it's about the size of Columbus every year.
Oh, yeah. That's right. And then if you look from 1975 to 2010, in 1975, there was one nonprofit for every 2,626 people. Now, last year there was one nonprofit for every 242 people. The population in that time frame has grown by 44%, but the number of nonprofits has grown by 1,460%. So the competition for donor and individual charitable time and dollars is fierce. And in fact, you know, sometimes in a downturn in the economy, that really begins to challenge some and means that some of the weaker ones that maybe should go away begin to fall by the wayside. And that's not always a bad thing.
Well, and we're talking about managing not-for-profits in a troubled economic time here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Given all of that, given that fierce sense of competition, I'm going to frame a question here. I'd like to talk about this kind of at the personal level for all of you. I'll start really with the on the end of the people who have to ask for funds for the work. Obviously, you're doing what you do because you believe in the mission of the organization. You're committed to it. There are other choices you might have been able to make, but this is the one that matters the most to you, and that's what drives you. How hard is it, Rebecca Seifert, to hear no when you go and say, I really need this money to help these people?
It is always hard to hear no. Fortunately, I don't hear no that often. Due in large part, I think that a lot of our donors come from the healthcare profession. Mm-hmm. So one, they know the importance of what we do. Mm-hmm. Number two, they know that we serve really the lowest income individuals and we serve some of the hardest to reach. And they know that I manage. I stretch a penny. I mean, I stretch 84 cents of every dollar raised goes to provide direct care. Mm-hmm. So that's a pretty significant number. And so that they know that we manage our money well mm-hmm. and provide a vital service to people who otherwise would not have that access to care.
Yeah, when I ran a not-for-profit for a few years, I used to say that I'm going to squeeze every quarter until the eagle screams.
I do that. Yeah.
And Michael Petrie, how hard is it for you to hear no? I mean,
we never want to hear it, do we? It's never easy. You know, I guess the silver lining to that cloud of no-ness is rarely is it a no never. Mm-hmm. Often it's just no, not right now. Whether it's a corporate or an individual, whomever it may be. And, you know, and I think they mean that. These folks, they do really want to support, but it just may not be in the cards at that time. That being said, it still hurts. But on the flip side, getting to unite a need mm-hmm. with a donor, there's probably no greater joy than mm-hmm. identifying that person or institution that can really help bring to fruition, bring to reality that dream. There is just almost no greater joy than seeing that happen.
Well, and I know you fundraise as well, Ellen, but I want to take the other side of the equation. As I was telling you at the break, my sister runs a foundation in upstate New York, and I remember talking with her when she took that job. She was very excited, and then a few months later, she said, you know, what I didn't realize coming in, I thought it was going to be wonderful. I'd be helping people and all of that, and I do get to do that. But the downside is that for every one person I say yes to, there are 9 or 10 good people I have to say no to, and that's not fun at all. How do you cope with that?
Well, but whether it's the fundraising side or the fund giving side, first of all, you can't take it personally. Mm-hmm. You really have to do the best you can do. And when I'm doing it on the fund giving side, I really think in terms of what I'm doing on behalf of donors, because we're using other people's money. And so I want to make sure that any investment we're making in organization, that we are looking at the highest performing, the highest impact organizations, and that I can look any donor in the eye at, and I say this to staff often, you know, personalize this, because I remember walking through the Target line once, and a cashier had a United Way logo on their name tag, and they had just completed the campaign. And I thought, I always want to be able to look that kid in the eye and say, I used your money well. So that really means that we sometimes have to make hard decisions, and sometimes it's a decision between two rights. Mm-hmm. It's a decision between two good organizations, but you have to come down on which one is maybe achieving more of the impact that you're trying to achieve. And, you know, we talk a lot about we want people to learn more, we want them to earn more, we want them to be healthy, and we want to have their basic needs met. And so if we feel like there are organizations that align with that in a better way and can reach more people, then that's when we make those tough decisions. It is not fun. But it's also, just as Michael said, when you connect that donor with the cause, it's also richly rewarding when you see that, you know, we had a part in making sure that this group got help, that these people succeeded. And I have the privilege of hearing just wonderful stories of human triumph on a daily basis. So that's also richly rewarding.
What was the toughest call you ever had to make, toughest decision not to fund?
Oh,
one
gosh.
That caused you the most distress?
Oh, that's a hard one. You know, I think for us, it's sometimes when there are some organizations, there are 10,000 nonprofits in Central Indiana, more than 10,000 in Central Indiana. And sometimes it's those organizations that serve a very small niche. It's an important niche. It's a small niche, though. And you just have to say, yeah, it's important, but with limited resources, and you can see perhaps it's something that is child serving or somebody with a very visible challenge, and you're just not able to serve everyone, and you just have to say it's not something that we can do, and I can't come up, you know, there's that's happened enough over the years, over the 22 years that I've been there, that there are times that you just there's nothing you can say except, you know, the other thing that happens, there was a child serving organization once who came, and they had actually gotten an increase, but for them to serve as many as they needed, they wanted their funds doubled. There was nothing we could do. And that's it's hard sometimes for the grantee to understand that.
Well, let me ask this, give you the opportunity now. So you have to say no less often. How should people give to United Way? What's the vehicle?
Well, the first thing they can do is come to the Pacer game tomorrow night.
Okay.
All the proceeds are on the 16th of December at 7 o'clock. All the proceeds come to United Way. And then they can go to the website at uwci.org. And there are lots of different ways to give, but also volunteer. We find today, and Michael mentioned this earlier, that people want to both connect personally as well as give, and they want to. Companies want volunteerism as well as giving opportunities, so we can do both of those things.
And that's
things.
One of the things that I found, actually, when that the people who actually donated their time actually ended up wanting to write larger checks, make more generous financial contributions because they saw where the need is. I wanted you, all of you have mentioned websites here where people can connect. How has the explosion of the internet and the web changed both fundraising and funding in this cycle? Do you have to watch out for scams and all of that? And Ellen, I'll keep it with you for a second.
Well, we've had a few scams pulled on us because of technology, not so much because of websites, but we've had a few pretty unscrupulous things happen where forged checks have been printed off and sent out to people and, you know, told if they cash it and then they, or if they send in their social security and cash it, then they'll get a larger check later. So we've had those kinds of scams. But, you know, I think what social media does, and I think we're still figuring all of this out, how you really connect with people. What it really does is give us a whole new ways to connect. We've got an emerging leaders group, and I think almost every organization is looking how to get young professionals involved. And social media is a great way. In fact, it's the only way when you're talking about young professionals. And it just opens up whole new arenas. It's also with some challenges because nonprofits don't always have the capacity or the know-how to use it well.
Michael Petry, in terms of the internet, how has it changed what you folks do?
It's a great forum for storytelling, isn't it?
Yes.
Compared to, gosh, back when it was just maybe direct mail pieces or broadcast media, suddenly, in literally the palm of our hands, everybody carries that opportunity to tell your story. And the kind of cool trend, I think, with YouTube and everything is that the story doesn't have to be polished. This doesn't have to be a video or a design document that is just high gloss, if you will. The grassroots level communication is in vogue. That's how you talk nowadays online and social media. It's a good time to be using social media.
Does that affect you as much, Rebecca, since you are serving, by and large, a clientele that is on the other side of the digital divide in many ways. So,
well, we have in the process of redesigning our website for the purpose of better connecting with the younger population and being, and hopefully through this redesign, the website, using social media more effectively. One of the things, too, with social media, at least with a small shop like ours, is the challenge of it can be very time-consuming. Because really, to use it effectively, you really have to be on it, blogging. You have to be out there, and that takes time. And so that's challenging when you're small.
Who needs a coffee break? We can just take a Facebook break.
Do whatever.
Yeah, but, I mean, you still have to – it has to be current. It has to be – to be vibrant, you have to be on it. And I wear a lot of hats. So that maybe could be something you could do.
You're not going to let me get out of this program now. You guys are just relentless. Well, let me ask here. We're getting close to the end of the program. What is the greatest challenge facing each of your organizations right now? Rebecca, I will come back to you on that one first.
I think a couple things. One, our patient population is getting older. When they're getting older, there are more health concerns. So how do we deal with that? And to me, that's huge. Our patients can't afford, for the most part, to pay for health care out of pocket. So they come to us. So how do we meet that need? Effectively serve them, providing them high quality of care. This isn't going to go away anytime soon.
Michael Petry, the largest challenge for the symphonic choir.
The symphonic choir's biggest single challenge is getting people to know about it. I really don't like that phrase of the best kept secret.
Yeah.
There's nothing good about that. But once you know the symphonic choir, funding follows.
Yeah, funding follows once people buy into the mission.
That's right, just fall in love.
Yep. Ellen Anila, biggest challenge in front of the United Way of Central Indiana.
Well, you know, the needs continue. There are just some huge needs that we have and opportunities in the community. But I'm going to talk about fundraising because donors and companies are changing. And I think one of the challenges, one of our biggest challenges is how do we personalize this? Because people have their own agenda. Companies have their own agenda for what they want to do with their philanthropic resources. So our challenge is how can we meet that donor need, that donor agenda, and meet the community need, be very strategic in terms of the community need. And it's that point of intersection when we do that I feel the most success. But it's also the biggest challenge because it's a very personal kind of fundraising. Mm-hmm. And we've got 1,200 companies that we interact with and 80,000 donors. And we have a staff that isn't that large. So
We have been talking about managing not-for-profits in a time of economic difficulty. We have been fortunate to have as our guest Ellen Anila of the United Way of Central Indiana, the president. Ellen, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
It's been a pleasure. Michael Petrie, executive director of the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir. Michael, thank you for joining us.
Indeed, my pleasure.
And Rebecca Seifert, who is the executive director of the Gennesaret Free Clinic. Rebecca, thank you for being here.
And thank you so very much.
I am John Kroll. Next week, we will be talking about the year's best movies. Please join us next Thursday at 1 p.m. Till then, have a great week.
No Limits is a production of WFYI Public Radio, 90.1 FM and HD1. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each Thursday at 1 p.m. for No Limits, rebroadcast at 8 p.m., and you can listen online at WFYI.org.